This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's 110 for a month or more. Can't go outside, hear the AC roar. It's like living in the pressure cooker. Super hot coil. Turn up the gas and burn that oil in the pressure cooker.
Half of scientists polled think we are headed for a 3°C hotter world within a single lifetime. From Exeter University, UK, Professor Tim Lenton returns with the 2024 State of the Climate Report. His colleague at Exeter, Dr. James Dyke, fact-checks a popular climate myth about overshoot. With author and activist Mike Tidwell, we talk hurricanes, Appalachia, and coping. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
Perilous times on planet Earth.
That is the state of our climate right now in 2024. Who says so? A really impressive group led by Oregon's William Ripple and complete with climate science leaders like Johan Rockström, Michael Mann, Naomi Oreskes, Stefan Rahmstorf, and Thomas Crowther, among many others, all Radio EcoShock guests, by the way. Talk us through the latest report in another big name in the field. It's Dr. Timothy Lenton. He is founding director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, chair in climate change and earth system science there, and a highly cited publishing scientist. From Exeter, UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be back.
We have been blown off the map of anything normal. How can scientists like your group help us to understand where we are?
Well, we're just trying to give a clear communication of the planet's vital signs. We do that by keeping track of a whole range of variables that are either the response of the climate itself to human activities or the human activities that are driving the climate change. And we're doing that year on year with this annual report. And once again, it's a shocking year, our assessment for the last 12 months.
And the State of the Climate Report starts off with a series of gut punches. The first sentence is, we are on the brink of an irreversible climate disaster. I had to stop and think that one over. Things do seem bad, but is that going too far?
Well, if we're thinking about this as a risk management problem, no, we're just trying to say that it's a bit like you'd approach getting on an aeroplane, I suppose. You want to be pretty sure it's not going to fall out of the sky. But the problem with the climate is the last 12 months or so has shown us some really extraordinary hot temperatures, particularly the ocean surface temperatures are just way out of the range of recent variability. And we're fairly confident now that 2024 is going to be the first year globally on record that's been 1.5 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial average, or more than that. And unfortunately, the climate science community can't yet come up with a convincing explanation for why the temperatures have deviated from so high and for so long. So I would interpret these extraordinary, we would call it temperature anomaly, as a kind of clear sign that there's some destabilization that's going on or gone on in the climate. And of course, we're hoping the temperatures come back, but they're still on the overall rise, along with a bunch of the other metrics we highlight.
Yes, Earth just went through a natural warming from El Nino plus our human-made heating. Is it possible, Tim, we could see a cooler year or two, or is it just hotter every year from now on? Do we know?
Well, we would expect, with the sort of variability that we get, for example, the El Nino has officially ended and yet the temperatures have stayed high, but we would normally expect that there will be some fluctuations. So we can easily go from and let's hope we do go from the current extraordinary heat to a cooler year or two. This is just normal that you get these shorter-term fluctuations around a rising average, shall we say. What's crazy about the current fluctuation above the average is it's just staying there, and it's much larger than we've seen before. But yeah, we would, if we get a strong landing year, as it's called, we would certainly expect to see some temporary cooling relative to this rising trend. But it's not arrived yet.
Another concern for me, there is not much wildlife out there left. I mean, wild mammals are about 4% of mammal biomass. The rest is all humans and our livestock. Is that a factor in this climate emergency?
Well, it is, particularly in the sense that the ruminant livestock, which is one of the indicators we track, not only are they at a record level, and we add something like 170,000 ruminant livestock to the global population every day, which seems extraordinary, doesn't it? Not only are they at a record level, but of course, ruminant livestock, they take an extraordinary amount of land. They're extremely inefficient, if you like, as a source of calories or protein. And they are an unusually strong source of methane emissions. And the land that they demand is in the global tropics, the single largest driver of tropical deforestation, which, of course, is itself a source of carbon dioxide being released from destroying the trees, essentially. And if we turn to the forest story, there's a little bit of good news that in the Brazilian Amazon, we saw in the last year a decline in the loss of the forest, although it still is being lost, just at a slower rate. But globally, over the last 12 months, we saw the global loss of tree cover really escalate, and that's partly not just because people were chopping forests down, but rather because there were really unprecedented massive areas of wildfires in the last year. And then that's also carbon that's adding to the atmosphere.
The United Nations process says 1.5 degrees C warming over pre-industrial is the line we should not cross, and I believe 190 countries agreed to that. According to your new report, a 2024 poll finds almost 80% of scientists responding expect heating by at least 2.5 degrees C. Fully half, foresee a catastrophic 3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100. Scientists know. Why doesn't the public?
The public, some of them also intuitively realize that things are heading way into the danger zone if we were to carry on with current policies. And that's why some of the public, at least, are joining us scientists in pushing our elected leaders to basically act more decisively in terms of specific policy actions that can accelerate the end of fossil fuel burning, the switch to cleaner, greener power, and so forth, tackling basically the key drivers of climate change.
And last March on Radio EcoShock, you gave us an update on tipping points. Something like slowing the North Atlantic current that keeps the UK weather moderate is huge. You just went through a kind of cool and wet period. It must be making people there nervous. It was bad for farming. But a lot of institutional publications and news media just leave tipping points out as if they don't exist. Tim Lenton, what should we be telling ourselves about climate risks possibly bigger than the civilization can handle?
Well, we need to wise up to the fact that that there's a significant risk of crossing climate tipping points that really would be a challenge for our societies, because they can fundamentally change the pattern of climate across the world. So suddenly what seemed like a nice habitable island with a huge number of people on it, like the UK or the UK islands, suddenly becomes a less good place to be if we cross a tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean's great overturning circulation. Now, the key thing in a risk assessment is to recognise that the thing you need to look at first is what's the worst thing that can happen and can I rule it out? And that's why I've been placing an emphasis on looking at these tipping point scenarios, because at the moment we definitely can't rule them out, and the more science we do, the more worrying it gets, because the more, rather than ruling them out, we start to see they look more likely than we thought thought they were. So, yeah, that's crucial information for all of us, but especially for governments, basically, who need to be putting the possibility of damaging climate tipping points into their risk thinking and their risk management. Because, of course, good governments are, they do have a process for thinking about risks, and that would include thinking about risks like another pandemic, like the COVID-19 pandemic, or thinking about terrorist risks, or thinking about a war, or yet another war escalating. But our argument, I think, would be pretty clear that these climate tipping point risks are, in some cases, quite a lot bigger if they were to come to pass than any of the other risks I just listed. So they definitely should be in our collective risk thinking, and certainly in our government's risk thinking.
Well, no doubt you have a comfortable home in England. Food in the grocery store is more expensive, but there is food. This new report, though, says we fear the danger of climate breakdown. Do you and other leading scientists believe that society itself could collapse if we get into a permanent state of climate emergency?
I think it's a definite risk. That's partly because when I and my group have looked at the climate model of passing, say, a key climate tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean circulation, combined with the 2.5 degrees of global warming that we should expect under current policies, and as you said, many climate scientists would expect later this century. When you combine those two things, the global warming and the tipping point, we can crop model and quickly discover that the viable area for growing the major staple crops of, say, wheat and maize worldwide reduced by more than a half. So that looks to me like a food security crisis, and it would be underlain by a kind of water security crisis. So that looks like a serious challenge to societies, and it would have many other ramifications as well. The whole pattern of climate would have changed. Of course, we might manage the situation by suddenly eating a lot less of those ruminant livestock, because they're using up a whole lot of agricultural land in the wild. It's hard not to conclude that it'll be extremely challenging to adapt to such a kind of climate shock that manifested as a food and water security shock, including in, you know, some of the richest and most populous nations, let alone for the less well-off people on the planet. Because we also see in that scenario there'd be major disruption of the Indian monsoon, so it'd be a crisis in India and the West African monsoon, so a crisis in the Sahelian regions and countries like Nigeria, one of the most populous countries in the world.
Imagine the sacrifice required to really slash our emissions personally and as an economy. I suppose it is less than sacrificing lives in war, but only just. At the moment, there's not much social or political will to do it. And we've been told for a long time, well, the next 10 years, that's critical. And those 10 years have passed. Is there a point where it is genuinely too late?
Well, there could well be a point at which things become too late, in the sense of too late to avoid the kind of risks that are hard to manage. But I wanted to emphasize that it's not a sacrifice to switch from a fossil fuel-powered societies to renewable energy-powered societies. On the contrary, renewable power is now the cheapest form of electricity in most of the world. In fact, it now makes economic sense in the majority of the world to close existing fossil fuel power stations and replace them with new renewables and battery storage. So we are seeing what I call some positive tipping points to a new energy system. We certainly need policy makers and policy support and governments to get behind those and to realise those opportunities. And they're huge opportunities, because still worldwide at least 5 million people die every year from fossil fuel air pollution. So, you know, you get multiple co-benefits from going to clean energy. We will also have to tackle our current trend towards eating more and more meat on average worldwide. You know, eating too much red meat can be extremely bad for your health. It's not actually good for you. So everything in moderation in that case. But there are co-health benefits. Healthier diets are much healthier for the planet.
But we seem to be moving in the wrong direction. I mean, BP, British Petroleum, have backed away from their climate goals. We have governments, whether they're liberal or conservative or whatever you want to call them, are approving new oil and gas drilling leases. Even in Australia, they're expanding coal mines. It's way too late for that kind of stuff. I just wonder, are you hopeful?
I'm pretty despairing when I see those things that you just mentioned, but I always try to remind myself of the bigger picture here, which is we are also seeing the exponential growth of renewable energy accelerating all the time. The same thing with the electrification of mobility, including electric cars, bikes, etc. So it's kind of a race of tipping points. In my head, it's a race to push and bring forward those positive tipping points to accelerate the change we need now versus in order to avoid the bad tipping points in the climate that we're otherwise going to cross. And you're quite right to highlight that what I would call the incumbents, the status quo, fossil fuel burning being part of it, and the meat lobby, they are fighting back hard. And alas, recently they would appear to be winning in some sense in terms of getting these crazy retrogressive movements from business and some governments. But things change quite, you know, they can fluctuate just as in the climate. They can change fast in society as well. So there are some other bigger forces going in the right direction. But we do look to be behaving very collectively stupidly at the moment. And we always pride ourselves for being a supposedly intelligent species, but there's really no evidence we are on this climate crisis, sadly.
I'm old enough to remember you, Michael, Johan, Naomi, and Stefan before climate became controversial and political. Even conservatives spoke of the need to address climate. Maggie Thatcher did. Then research scientists were called to be public speakers and media communicators. I've never seen Stefan Rahmstorf speaking in more forums and tweeting and communicating as much. You yourself, you're getting out, you're making presentations. It's a change from just researching and reporting to the authorities, well, we have climate problems.
Oh, yeah, because we're human beings after all, and we get to stare day in, day out at this extraordinary, shocking evidence of how the climate is changing and the harms it's causing to people. And you can't, on your conscience, not go out and try and alert the world, both to the risks we see unfolding right now, but also try and alert the world to the only viable remaining opportunities to get out of trouble, which is really we have to tip to different technologies and different behaviours, but they actually bring a bunch of benefits with them. But we obviously need our elected leaders to get on board with that change as well. So we're going out to tell the world what the trouble is and how the trouble is escalating, but also, well, what's the only viable ways left to get out of this trouble before it gets too bad for anybody to manage it.
Well, there are unlikely to be massive climate protests in Azerbaijan at the next COP, the COP climate meeting in November, coming right up. Do you see any signs there could be some changes there that will at least help the climate?
At the COP meeting, I'm not feeling too optimistic of fundamental shifts coming from that process. In terms of the climate movement, I would love to see it back on the streets even more strongly, because I think that just makes it visible for everybody that there is an issue. Even if you as a listener disagree with the tactics of the movement, I think the movement has and can play an essential role in just continually reminding us all about what's happening. And obviously, we do that as scientists in our own this slightly different way, but I really do think we need to get this up our mental agenda and in order to fuel the action we need, and of course get it on the political radar in a way that it sticks as a priority for our leaders to address for all of our benefits, frankly. I mean, there's so much to gain in embracing the transition now, especially to clean energy. So what are we waiting for? Well, as usual, it's vested interest in the status quo is what's holding things back.
Tim, we're going to have to wrap this up. What are you and your team working on next?
Well, I've been working on what are the most effective policies to bring forward what I call the positive tipping points in the power sector to renewable energy, in the electrification of cars and trucks, in electrifying the heating of our homes. And we've been able to show that policies that mandate the end of fossil fuel technologies, like you're not going to be able to sell a petrol or diesel car in our market after 2035, or no diesel trucks after 2040, or we're going to close all coal-burning power stations by 2035 in rich nations. Those policies are hugely effective at triggering, amplifying feedbacks that accelerate the change we need, that make the new clean technologies cheaper and better, faster. They're way more effective than carbon taxes that have been talked a lot about. And subsidies are also fairly effective, but mandates are even more effective. So I've really been trying to bring that message out with some real numbers showing, you know, how particular policies could really help us accelerate out of trouble. And on the flip side, me and my group, we're really trying our best to improve our early warning systems, early warning capability for the bad climate tipping points. And we're doing what we can to mine the data we've got available to look for the early warning signals that crucial bits of the climate are losing stability.
Listeners, find out where you do stand. Check out the 2024 State of the Climate Report, Perilous Times on Planet Earth. It is free, it's easy to understand, and full of facts that are a bit hard to hear. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guest is co-author Dr. Timothy Lenton, founding director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. Tim Lenton, thank you for your valuable time and for your warning.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Some people see the future more clearly. In 2012, I interviewed American author and activist Mike Tidwell about his book. The title might as well be today's headlines: The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. That is surely where we are now, with double hurricanes and the future of coastal Florida in doubt. Mike Tidwell is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. They work on global warming impacts and solutions in Maryland and Virginia and Washington, D.C. and beyond. From Washington, Mike Tidwell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here, Alex.
Mike, what hits you most about Hurricanes Helene and Milton striking Florida and then the Southeast?
I suppose it's just the surreal feeling of a slow-moving nightmare that all the things many of us have been saying are going to happen are actually happening. And in the suffering, people paying with their lives by government and policy community not heeding these warnings that people like me have been putting out there for quite a while. And then the final consequence is people dying by the hundreds across the United States. And now, as we speak, another hurricane has ripped across Florida. So it's one of sadness, honestly.
Well, yes, and while all this is happening, there was a massive heat wave across the U.S. Southwest, and more people were dying in the heat there, but there wasn't room in the media to cover it. Have you been in touch with any people who are struggling in the Appalachians after the deadly floods caused by Helene?
Yes. One of the groups that I work closely with on climate issues on the East Coast of the U.S. is a group called Appalachian Voices, and their main office is in Boone, North Carolina. Their office was completely flooded. This was also a group that's raising awareness about climate change, warning of the fact that with these fantastic precipitation events that we're now getting, either from hurricane remnants or just from more moisture in the atmosphere, that narrow valleys and narrow and steep valleys of the sort you see in much of Appalachia, there's just nowhere for the water to go. And so the rivers rise higher, the surrounding infrastructure floods faster, and the leaders of Appalachian Voices, this scrappy climate and environmental justice group, you know, had their office devastated.
So ironic and so wrong. I have a friend who lives on higher ground in Asheville, North Carolina. Their river view is displaced by rubble. There is no power, drinking water, or sewage services, and they're not coming back soon because the actual facilities were damaged. Schools and all other services are closed, of course, and the couple had to quickly enroll their two high school kids in a Christian school further north, not their first choice, but that's what was available. So then my friends watched bodies being pulled out of tree tangles and toxic mud. The mud there is toxic from all the products we use getting washed into the waterways there. This is really bad what happened inland and so unexpected from a Gulf hurricane, don't you think?
The Appalachian Mountains, you know, we see this kind of flooding in the past. Camille in 1969 brought fantastic flooding to parts of Appalachia and Virginia, and Agnes in 1972, I think it was, also brought this amazing amount of flooding. But what we're seeing now is it's just happening more frequently. We're seeing heavier rainfall. Everything that we've known in terms of weather and climate patterns in the past are now just amplified, and we should not be surprised that that includes these remnant hurricanes killing communities and human beings.
In 2012, Hurricane Sandy struck Washington and your beloved Chesapeake Bay. Do you think people there are more prepared now when the next one comes?
I wish I could say yes. I mean, shoreline property is still very much desired along the 3,000 miles of tidal shoreline of the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic coast here. What we are seeing, similar to around the country, is rapidly rising homeowners insurance rates. I think across the country, rates are up as much as 25% on average since 2017. And then, of course, places like Florida, the homeowners insurance is 3.5 times more than the national average. We're seeing that in the Chesapeake region, and it should be, you know, a warning sign to a lot of people. But with the increased amount of population and wealth in the East Coast of the United States, apparently the message isn't getting through. But we're seeing just fantastic changes in the Chesapeake Bay. It's a shallow bay. It averages 20 feet, so it's very sensitive to temperature change. We've seen dramatic rise in surface temperatures of the waters of the Chesapeake Bay. And if, you know, the right hurricane comes from the right angle, you know, with a tight hurricane eye, kind of like Hurricane Wilma. If we were to get a Hurricane Wilma with those kind of high speeds right up the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, you could see just fantastic destruction as far away as Washington, D.C., and, of course, Baltimore.
Well, you know, after the big hurricanes, the media only covers the human deaths and the destroyed homes and buildings. Humans don't even think about all the natural spaces that might be destroyed or ecosystem damage. Do these big storms damage the natural systems like in Chesapeake Bay?
They do. They leave, Hurricane Isabel in 2003 just completely severed a barrier island, an important barrier island off the coast of Maryland. Where before it was one island, afterwards it was two. We get tremendous damage to underwater grasses and to forests. And this is certainly happening in Florida as we speak. You know, when forests are subjected to such high winds and there's tree mortality and then there's saltwater intrusion, I mean, it can take generations for forests to become healthy again. And so, yes, there's always a long-lasting recovery time when it comes to the larger environment and the ecosystems. And unfortunately, as we all know, these disruptions are now coming in faster and faster cycles.
We'll be right back with Mike Tidwell. Then UK scientist James Dyke exposes the climate myth everyone loves.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This